Chapter 24. The Going Forth. Cassoli was so cold, and so full of damp white mist that came flying in over the fir tree tops, as it were in large lumps, that I was reminded of Goom. Satchapriya had returned to Raipur for me, and together we had travelled up into the Punjab hills. But though the gradual change of scene must have been of absorbing interest, my sole memory of the journey is getting out of the ramshackle bus halfway between Kalka, the railway terminus, and Kasauli, and being violently sick owing to the sudden change of altitude. Panditji and Sudhir, who had arrived a few days earlier, were waiting for us at the bus stand. As the four of us walked through the streets of the small hill station, I could not help remarking on the extraordinarily large number of well-groomed and obviously wealthy Sikhs we saw, the stalwart, bearded and turbaned men clad in beautifully tailored English suits, the plump women and girls wearing satin pyjamas, knee-length tunics, and with the two ends of the muslin scarf that covered their full breasts flung over their shoulders and floating out behind. Many had big new cars that flashed with chromium plate, and most, whether men or women, glittered with expensive jewellery. Panditji explained that they were millionaire businessmen from West Punjab, who, with independence approaching and the division of the province between India and Pakistan imminent, had fled for safety to Kasauli, which was in East Punjab. So much was communal hatred already ablaze that some, fearing for their lives, had hastily crammed as many valuables as possible into their cars and driven away, abandoning house and furniture to the fury of the mob. Whether because of this influx of moneyed refugees or for other reasons, there was a shortage of accommodation in Kasauli. Satyapriya and I were fortunate to find refuge in the guest house of Lala Pyarelal, a wealthy Punjabi businessman, to whom Panditji had introduced us. This gentleman's house was perched on the cliff edge at the far end of the bazaar, up whose narrow cobbled streets, so steep they were almost stairs, we had to climb to visit Panditji in the residential section of the town higher up. 50 feet below the house was a narrow rocky ledge whereon stood the guest house. To this we had access by a weed-flanked path that descended from the main street of the bazaar, ran straight past Lala Pyarelal's front gate, and then, dropping sharply, looped round to meet the rocky ledge. Within the loop, at a level halfway between the house and the guest house, stood a large cement platform, which, though roofed in, was enclosed only by stout wire mesh. In this structure, designed for fine weather social and religious functions, Andamai had stayed for 5 days, before going up to Solon, the capital of a small hill state of that name, the ruler of which was one of her devotees. Despite the Persian rugs with which the rich businessman had spread the floor and covered the wire mesh, Andamai's disciples had shivered. But the mother herself, we were told, had shown remarkable indifference to the extreme cold. This we were by no means astonished to learn. In Kishengunj, eyewitnesses had related how a truculent devotee once challenged her to show what difference there was between herself and an ordinary person. Calling for a shovel full of burning coals, she dropped one into her open palm, and without the slightest change of expression in her laughing face, allowed it to burn there for several minutes. "Can you do this?" she mockingly demanded of the horrified devotee. On examination, it was found that her hand had been badly scorched. Despite the change of climate and atmosphere, the way in which Satyapriya and I passed our days did not greatly vary from the routine established at Raipur. Meditation, study, and in my case literary work, continued to occupy the major part of our time. Thanks to the kindness of our host, we were spared the necessity of preparing so much as a cup of tea with our own hands. Twice a day, punctual to the minute, there came down from the house two trays, each containing a stack of piping hot chapatis liberally smeared with ghee, half a dozen bowls filled with lentil soup and curries, a brass tumbler of hot milk, together with fruit and sweetmeats. So rich was the fare that, accustomed as I had been to a more Spartan diet, I soon developed diarrhoea. Satchapriya, who boasted of having swallowed 40 large sweetmeats at a time in his student days for a wager, remained unaffected. At least once a day, Lala Parielal came down to inquire if we were comfortable and whether we needed anything. Though all Indians are by nature so warmly hospitable that it might appear invidious to make comparisons between the people of different provinces in this respect, Punjabi hospitality is overwhelming, even by Indian standards. In the case of our present host, his modest, almost diffident manner added to his attentions a grace which mere lavishness could never have commanded. He was, moreover, a man of genuine piety, and when, during one of his visits, we confided to him our spiritual aspirations, they met with a deeply sympathetic response. One thing only Lala Parielal could not provide us with, and that was with warmth. With a wall of wet rock behind, and a billowing sea of damp white mist below, and with our quarters themselves all stone, cement, and corrugated iron, it was not astonishing that for all the blankets he heaped upon us, we shivered by night and froze by day, our chapped hands so stiff the fingers would hardly open, and our feet like blocks of ice. Whether because of the cold, or by way of natural progression, there stole over our meditations a peculiar numbness. Often we spent the whole session in a dull, semi-conscious twilight state, from which we were aroused only when our heads jerked forward heavily onto our chests. Later we learned that this experience, known as yoga nidra, or yogic sleep, is quite a common one. Beginners are warned not to mistake it for the superconscious state of samadhi. It corresponds, in fact, to the subtle physical world, or astral plane, and with practice, shadows may be discerned moving about in it, as though in depths of gloomy water. Our only means of getting warm was a brisk walk into town, but rain and drizzle, and I believe hail, at times conspired to prevent even this respite from the cold. Panditji we seldom saw. Our ties with him had in fact loosened. Though he was bursting with plans, and doing his utmost to coax from the pockets of Lala Parielal and other business magnates of the town funds for his Anandamayi boarding school, there was now no talk of Buddhism, the more clearly we saw how rapidly he was drifting away from our previous objectives, the feebler grew our enthusiasm. Besides, we had made other friends, and though we still felt a quasi-affection for the aged adventurer, who on his part continued to treat us with great kindness, now that we were beginning to have an insight into the true nature of his activities, we could not help sometimes preferring their company to his. The most valuable of our new acquaintances was Dr. Guru Kipal Singh, a devout Sikh working on malaria control at the Central Research Laboratory, the possession of which constituted the town's sole title to fame. My own connection with him was closer than Satchapriya's, and there were long conversations on Sikhism, in which my friend did not participate. Once he took us to a lonely place on the outskirts of the town, and showed us a tiny hermitage perched in isolation on a spur of rock. Here, observing a vow of complete silence, had lived for many years a great ascetic, whom Dr. Singh regarded as his guru. The wild, deserted spot, which we saw late one afternoon through a veil of thick mist and fine rain, was silent with an intense silence of that eerie, strangely vibrant quality one finds in long-used cremation grounds far from any human habitation. As we stood there, thinking of the occupant of the hermitage, about whom were related many strange tales, I became aware that there existed between the old recluse and me a bond of profound sympathy and occult understanding, and that there were wings fluttering within me, yearning to spread themselves in the same infinite sky as that wherein, scorning all earthly ties, he had made his ascent. Though I remember clearly only Guru Kripal Singh, we must have made other friends who, from a distance of so many years, merged into an anonymous collectivity. For on Independence Day, the 15th of August 1947, I was invited to address the public meeting that was held at Kasauli, as at every other place, whether city, town or village, throughout the length and breadth of the newly born subcontinent. That even in such a remote place everybody could think it right and natural that an Englishman should be asked to speak on the great occasion showed not only how little room for bitterness there was in Mother India's heart now that independence had been achieved, but also with what nobility of spirit the struggle for it had been waged. By 10 o'clock the populace had mustered 2,000 strong in the town square. Though the sky had been overcast since early morning, the rising of a high wind had eventually swept away the clouds, so that, on standing up to speak, I found myself in the midst of a sunlit expanse of dazzling white shirts and colourful turbans. In undemonstrative but unmistakably cheerful groups at the back of the crowd stood more than 100 English men, women and children. As the Indian tricolour fluttered up the flagpole in front of the rostrum, and the mounting excitement of the crowd exploded in deep-throated cheers, the joy that was reflected in all faces made it impossible to feel that any considered themselves losers in the struggle for independence. 3 days later, Satyapriya and I celebrated our personal Independence Day. Even at Kishengunj we had noticed that, although Anandamayi's devotees generally treated Panditji with all the respect due to his age and learning, he seemed to command no confidence whatever in matters organisational and financial. Indeed, on the eve of our departure, one of the devotees, a retired government official, had taken us aside and quietly warned us that the old man had long been notorious for his dishonesty, and that we should on no account allow ourselves to become involved in any of his schemes. We were being used, he declared, simply as bait for Panditji's latest traps. Unwilling to believe that a scholar could be a cheat and a liar, we had at the time dismissed this warning as the outcome of prejudice, if not of hostility, towards Buddhism. But in both Raipur and Kasauli, we were often given cause to remember it. A number of small incidents revealed to us Panditji's utter lack of principle. Though not ungenerous in spending money, he was obviously quite unscrupulous as regards the means of its acquisition. He had, on his own admission, neither regular income nor permanent headquarters. His wife was living in destitution in Calcutta. And it was with growing horror that we realized he spent his time moving from place to place, collecting, on one plausible pretext after another, funds that were never used for the purpose for which they had been donated. Only the good nature, or perhaps the indolence, of his victims had saved him from prosecution. After discussing the matter with Lala Parialal, who had been duped by Panditji several years earlier, we felt that in leaving the Mahabodhi Society, we had jumped out of the frying pan into the fire. There was only one way out. Religious societies, organizations, and groups, far from being a help to spiritual development, were only a hindrance. However lofty the ideals with which they were founded, they had a natural tendency to degenerate in the hands of selfish human beings into instruments for the acquisition of money, position, power, and fame. Instead of trying any longer to work with them, we would follow the example of the Buddha and sever at one stroke our connection with an incorrigible world. We would renounce the household life and go forth into the life of homelessness as wanderers in search of truth. For the last few months, we had only sat hesitantly on the shore of the vast ocean of the spiritual life. Now, casting aside all fear, we would plunge boldly in. Having made this resolution, we lost no time in putting it into effect. With the help of a handful of Gerua Mati, the reddish-brown earth used since time immemorial by Indian ascetics, we dyed our shirts and sarongs the traditional saffron of the world renunciant. Suitcases and watches were sold, trousers, jackets and shoes given away, identification papers destroyed. Apart from the robes that we were to wear, we kept only a blanket each and our books and notebooks. As for the last 3 months, hair and beard had been allowed to grow. We did not need shaving tackle. On the eve of our departure, we went to bid farewell to Panditji. Though he had not been entirely ignorant of our intentions, the emotions that distorted his venerable countenance, now that our defection had become a reality, were horrible to behold. Gone was the urbane mask. In its place were astonishment, rage, indignation, baffled greed, frustrated cunning, guilt surprised, and despair, all in conflict. More dreadful still were his desperate attempts to regain his composure. Despite his efforts to smile, to be affable, to wave aside our resolution as a boyish fancy, the mask kept slipping from his face, and we saw again and again the face of a monster. Eventually, optimistic and fertile of invention as ever, he expostulated with us for our perversity, our ungratefulness even, in thinking of deserting him at the moment when his plans were on the verge of fruition, when a large building was about to be donated for the Andamayi Girls' School, and when Lala Parielal and other wealthy merchants were on the point of placing at his disposal large sums of money. If we left, the whole scheme would be jeopardized. Out of consideration for his feelings, if for no other reason, he pleaded, we should at least postpone our departure for a few weeks, even a few days. But though we could not help feeling touched by his appeals, we now knew him far too well to place any further reliance on his protestations, and remained firm in our resolve. At last, not without tears, he allowed us to go. Next morning, after joyfully donning our saffron robes, we walked, feeling shy and rather conspicuous, through the bazaar to Dr. Guru Kipal Singh's house. Lala Parielal and other friends, though regarding our aspirations with sympathy, did not feel at all happy about our decision, which, in their opinion, was rash. Only Dr. Singh wholeheartedly approved. With him, therefore, we had agreed to take breakfast before leaving Kasali. Apart from one of his sons, a stalwart youth who accompanied us part of the way, our worthy Sikh friend, whose deep emotion when he wished us success in our quest both humbled and heartened us, was the last person to whom we spoke before setting out on foot along the 10-mile road that led to the plains. Tibetan Buddhists believe that the appearance of a rainbow is one of the most auspicious of signs, and the biographies of their saints and yogis are replete with references to this phenomenon. Whether our going forth on the 18th of August 1947 may be considered an auspicious event, I cannot say, but it was certainly signalized by the appearance not of one, but of scores of rainbows. As we left Cassoli, it was raining, but as in the course of our descent we emerged from the clouds into the bright sunshine below, we saw arching the road, at intervals of a few dozen yards, not only single, but double and triple rainbows. Every time we turned a bend, we found more rainbows waiting for us. We passed through them as though through the multicoloured arcades of some celestial palace. Against the backdrop of bright sunshine, jewel-like glittering raindrops, and hills of the freshest and most vivid green, this plethora of delicate seven-hued bows seemed like the epiphany of another world.